finally found the most generic live show. This is the Generic Live Show with Dale Campbell.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Generic Live Show. This is GLS diving into a brand new broadcasting week. Thank you so much for joining us. And yes, we are diving into a brand new week here on the broadcast, here on a Wednesday the 4th of November. I'm Dale Campbell. As always, we are here to protect and serve on your GLS for the evening. 30 seconds or less, I'll get to the big story of the day here on a Wednesday. But first, we have some crazy things that happen sometimes here on the show, and they can't really be avoided. Now, I was doing a mic check. You know, it's a fun environment here on the show. We're laughing, we're goofing off, we're here, I have coffee, and all of a sudden, I decided to go, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use the voice editing feature on this show, on this broadcasting network that I have. So I now present to you 36 seconds of Dale Campbell singing Drake's, well, not really singing, but I present to you 30 seconds of Dale Campbell singing Hotline Bling. I'll enter at your own risk.
All right. Testing 1, 2, 1, 2. You should call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. And I know when that hotline bling. That can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline bling. That can only mean one thing. Ever since I left the city.
That's, yeah, okay. Not my finest artwork, but funny nevertheless. I thought we were having a good laugh at here on the show. Now, back to Siri. Oh, you know what? That's why I gave you that little clip here. I want to ease you in to this investigative story that I'm doing here on GLS on a Wednesday. Privatization of the university. Now, the Conversation AU, they have a piece on a focus on private investment means universities cannot fulfill their public role, which I thought was excellent because I put this in the run sheet early in the week and I put a post about it on my public page on at Dale Campbell. Dale Campbell. If you wanna like my page, it's at facebook.com/DaleMurrayCampbell. If you wanna find me on there, that's exactly right. But it's interesting. This article talks about, and I was going to bring up something else as well in regards to this the local university here in the city where I live, where I'm doing this current broadcasting from, is decided to sell out all of its food and dining options as well to third-party businesses, which would mean the university is no longer providing these services to its students. Now, this article is an interesting one, so I'll read the article and then I'll get into kind of sort of a debate here. And if you want to contribute at all to the debate, we have all of our ways that you can interact with the show. I have the Facebook page open. I even have my emails open. I have the Chef Wanna Media chat room. There's always, remember, comments on the podcast later. There's Google Plus. So this article says that the decline in government investment in higher education and the ever-increasing reliance on fees and other sources of income has made universities more private for-profit corporations. As institutions of higher learning that receive government funding, universities are obligated to fulfill a public role, writes Margaret Thornton, Professor of Law, ANU College of Law, Australian National University. As students assume more and more the cost of their higher education, they tend to view it as a personal private investment that benefits them rather than the public good. Conservative economics will tell you that fee-paying students are rational egologists primarily concerned about maximizing the return on investment, which is true, which is why we go to university. We go to university to better ourselves, to get something out of that, and we pay for that service. I can tell you that for personal experience. This means that they're anxious to graduate and obtain the best paying jobs as possible. The focus on applied knowledge has led to a decline in critical thinking as well, this article points out. It has increased on all disciplines, but the humanities have suffered the most because of their perceived inability to generate profits. Research valued over teaching. Research, not teaching, is a beneficiary of increased revenue received from the profitization of students. This article states that less money that is spent on teaching through casualization of staff, the preference is on large lectures rather than interactive small groups, and the modes of assessment are quick to mark. Our full-term academics are now expected to prioritize research, particularly applied research, over teaching, because it is more lucrative for the university, which I would, you know what, I would agree with that statement. I mean, I've read this article, and it is quite a bit extreme, but I will side on this, on the side of, you know, it being focused towards research, particularly here in the town that I'm in, and they kind of focus more on marine studies and research subjects as well. There's more researching subjects where the lecturers actually have research and get students to do research because it's more lucrative to them. Justice and equity, they can't serve the role in justice and equity. Universities perform a civic role in preparing graduates to go out into the community, but high fees have the potential to screw leadership positions in the professions in the public service favor of sons and daughters of the wealthy. Fee deregulation inadvertently shifts the balance away from the egalitarian values of equality, access of upwards mobility, and less well-off. Middle-class students are more likely to see high costs for degrees and an investment, whereas the less-off tend to determine the prospect of subdual debt. Kind of it skews the social scales in favor of the wealthy, which is fair. There's a lot of middle class people trying to get an education and get a leg up, per se, and for audio listeners that's air quotes, get a leg up in kind of a better education system for them and for all involved as well. When the public good role is compromised by the market, there are many revelations of late of universities admitting or passing substandard students because they are full fee paying. So they're passing students who are meeting the requirements as well. They're not meeting requirements, but they're kind of just passing them because they're already paying all the fees, and then they won't be on government record for the rest of eternity as well. Some universities have accepted donations by company where contractual details have shrouded in secrecy and the independence of researchers could be compromised. So, and vice chancellors and CEOs are joining that $1 million club. I mean, if I can't really reveal because of my role with the local school, the university campus here in my town, I can't really reveal many closed door kind of things like that, but that is kind of where they're going with that, they're more focusing on the rich education side of it, which both kind of weigh up. I mean, if you make university too much more of a middle class battle, you're kind of battling with yourself. But if you're making it fairer for the middle class to kind of get away in this society, it makes it a little bit more, kind of more balanced, but you don't want, I hate to say this out loud, because this is an argument that I have voted against in the past, but if you make universities open to those in the middle class, you are going to get people who aren't really motivated as well and have big debts tied to them as well. And we have an article coming up later in the second hour where they're planning to, why it's good to push the fees back to when we die, which is kind of a terrible thing to think about at a young age like mine, is to have debts building up until we die. But the point is that this article brings up some very, very fair points. I'm kind of torn between, is it right or is it wrong to assume, excuse me while I itch my ear apparently, but what is it so terrible to have kind of a mixture of both universities, which, because they are mixtures of both universities in this country, where some of them are exclusively for rich people and some of them are exclusively for the middle class people, and of course others are kind of a mixture of those, because that's how social economics works, children. Social economics 101, you have lots of social classes located in different regions. Like, who are you going to target? That's dependent on the company and the organization themselves. What do they want to see themselves as? Do they want to see themselves as kind of a higher end university, or do they want to see themselves as a bit of a scum university? And I did want to make this a local story, but I wanted to bring up that article because it is a good article to bring up, because it does bring up so many points that is happening here locally. This, our local university is being sold off, per se. It is being torn apart, and it is being kind of pulled to pieces, if you want to kind of put an analogy on it, with the announcement. Of course, I said it a bit earlier in this segment, I said that the food outlets are being, that's air quotes for audio listeners, that the food outlets are being branched off. The problem with the universities is, universities in this country want to take a branch approach to serving the students. Remember, the students are the customers of the university at the end of the day. I mean, I'm a full disclaimer, I'm a marketing student majoring in business student majoring in human resources and marketing. This is my DO. But don't you dare branch off the university in different departments to benefit those of the upper class. You're just excluding, you know, people within your own target demographic. It just kind of, it doesn't really fit with where you're going. You can't directly shift that dramatically within a year. So I have a copy of an email that was an email memo that was sent out to both students and staff as well, to inform people of that. Do I read the letter on air? No, I won't. It comes from the Deputy Vice Chancellor. There's been some discussion about the Student Association and political runnings within the BDA as well. We just haven't reported them on the show because, realistically, they haven't been big enough to make a big splash. You have to make a big splash to get on this show. It does say that the Student Association will focus more on student orientation. However, the food and beverage side of things will no longer be operated by the student association of the local university campus. This includes the refectories, both in Cairns and Townsville, the Green Play cafes in both locations, the Boathouse here in Cairns, I've already set the location, and various coffee carts around the various locations. There are talks with a number of providers, with an S, third-party providers, mind you. I will add that emphasis because I think it's an emphasis that is important. Third-party providers in these areas in 2016. They will provide exciting and new menus together with the external operators such as Jeanette's Miss Sushi, Jamaica Blue, and Delish Cafe are due to open on the Cairns campus. They are here locally. I don't really want to go out and edit that. hey, it's live. It's live to hard drive, and there's nothing you can do about it. I don't know why I'm singing. Anyway, it's expected that an excellent variety of food and coffee will be available to students. I am reading parts of this email, so I'm not reading... There will be parts to this. There are maintenance required for these new providers to be commencing trading in January and February as well to ensure that they are ready for the new year. Now, it's what they don't say in this email, which, okay, I'm going to be frank here. It pings me off, and you do realize that I have toned this down. I have watered down this segment to a PG rating enough at 10:17 at night. I've watered it down enough because this is a PG show. This is a family-friendly show. I don't want to drop F bombs and that sort of thing. But by golly, it has been tempting. Yes, I just did say the phrase, by golly, live on the radio. Yeah, you just heard that. Yes, you did. But anyway, the thing they don't mention here is that all of the staff will lose their jobs. All of the food, I don't know about the catering. I don't know if the catering ring, the catering wing will lose their jobs. I'm not too sure about that one, but all of the people who power the food outlets themselves will be made redundant, unfortunately. I've been going to this campus for 3 years. And let me tell you about how people get stuck in their daily grind all the time. But it's amazing that how much these people matter to you when you go get your coffee every morning for 3 years. I've been going to that campus. I am in my third year, actually. I've been going there for a while now. I'm in my third year. I'm going into my fourth year when all these new operators are planning to open up. All of those will be made redundant. They can apply for these new positions if they so desire. That's kind of ridiculous. And by the way, this is me been asking those people that sort of thing as well. And they can provide. They can if they so desire. That is the most ridiculous thing I think I've ever heard. But in saying that, they can if they so desire, or they can seek work placement elsewhere as well. It's ridiculous. It's outrageous. It's ridiculous. And for them to kind of make these changes and go, nope, you're out. I understand that these things have to happen, but it's kind of silly that it's one of the things that really irks me when they don't take humans into consideration. Mind you, these people didn't find out until I found out They got the same email when I did, and that is heart-wrenching stuff. Now, I've heard from students, and we do have to take our break here soon, but I have heard feedback on this from both sides. It sucks that they're losing their job. Yes, it sucks that the SA can't provide benefits for students for food and coffee to potentially bring more revenue in that way. Yes, I understand that. But I did hear complaints about staff and that sort of thing. But that's a staffing issue. That's not the university's issue as a whole to try and make money as well. And I do see that. I do see the other side as well. It's kind of like, well, it's ridiculous. And it's so far second thought. These people have been thrown out on the dark. There are people at the other end of this deal that need to be considered as well. And in 30 seconds, I'll be quick. In 30 seconds, I just want to say that this is not the last you'll hear of this story. I will be passionate on this issue. You can bet. Because it just, it's something that is close, it's near and dear to my heart. Definitely. And It won't be the end. It won't be. It's the beginning, but it's definitely not the end. As we continue here on GLS, well, we have a study here that is interesting and bizarre. It has to do with climate change and political biases. The more you go up on the political spectrum, the more your opinion of climate change gets stronger. As we continue here on GLS, it's 10:22.
This is The Generic Live Show with Dale Campbell. Played a game right from the start. I trust you, you use me, and now my heart's all torn apart. I'm sailing.
Thank you for joining us here on a Wednesday. As I find my knob here, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to be here, whether you're listening to us on the line or on your hard drive. We do appreciate you tuning in and choosing GLS. We know you have lots of live shows to choose from, and we appreciate your listenership. Now, an update on the story that we had planned in the schedule. We still have that story planned in the schedule. Don't you worry about that. But it shows it's interesting. Considering that the Labour Party here in Australia has seized on a CSIRO report showing that most Australians believe that human-induced climate change is real, saying that it shows Malcolm Turnbull government is avoiding action. The study released today showed that 78% of people believed climate change to be real, and about 60% of the efforts to climate change were related to human activity. While Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has embarrassed the role of science and renewable energy in the climate change policy, a few changes have been made since he took office. Environment Minister Greg Hunt said this week, a change in the new Office of Climate Change and Renewables Intervention, after the then PM Tony Abbott, that's where I wrote Tony Abbott, dumped the climate change environment. But the CSIRO study showed many coalition voters remain skeptical of the role of humans in climate change activity. The study showed that 52% of Liberal voters in this country, Liberal voters, said that climate change was real, but natural. 42% of national party voters showed that 42% of national voters showed, 31% of Labour voters showed this, and 17% showed were also agreeing that the climate change was real, but it's natural. 22% of national voters and 28% thought that human activity was related to climate change, compared to 59% of Labour voters and 76% of Green voters. But Labour's environment spokesperson Mark Butler said that the Turnbull government has done quote-unquote nothing to, quote, make amends for the unconceivable behaviour of Tony Abbott. He said, given the report's findings, it showed that the Liberal government isn't interested in taking meaningful action, quote-unquote. But Mr. Hunt asked in China this week whether, quote, those Abbott government days are over, and, quote, you have absolute confidence in supporting the renewable energy target and more generally for renewable energy sector. Despite approving what Australia's largest coal mine, Andy Carmichael, said that Mr. Hunt, apparently we are completely source blind in terms of what type of electricity supply. Ahead of global talks in Paris to set global emission targets, he told the audience in China that was, quote, one of the indispicable pillars of a good global agreement. Listen, mummy and daddy are fighting. They're fighting over, they're fighting over climate change. Never mind. But anyway, no, I'm not mocking climate change. I'm just saying that we don't need to attack each other. We need to do something. Hello, I'm not an extremist. I'm just saying facts. I'm just saying that something needs to be done. We need to do something. Therefore, is not nothing. If I learnt one thing from two Autobots fighting each other, that something is not nothing. Therefore, everything is always something. As we continue here on GLS, and I want to say my perspective in 2 seconds or less, because that's all we have time for, because we are running a little bit behind. But I just want to say, I'm confused that liberal voters are showing a tendency to believe that climate change is real but natural, and 31 Labour and 17 Green voters. I have a question, and I'm not jumping on any political party, but why are they jumping on independent people, independent companies that do research into climate change and making it all politicized? Did they just need to get their fingers out of pies and do real action? That's what that, ladies and gentlemen, is what. So I get off my soapbox here. Oh, hang on. There you go. I'm off my soapbox now. Maybe I'm getting off of my soapbox and getting into a new Volvo self-driving car. As we continue, it's 10:31.
On Twitter, just use the hashtag GLS show. This is a generic live show with at the Dale King.
Joining us here on a Wednesday with Dale Campbell here on GLS. That's right. If you want to find him on Twitter, you can just use at the Dale Campbell. I am at the Dale Campbell on Twitter. Yes, that's right. And I love getting tweets from people, even though it doesn't happen often. When I do get tweets from people, it's a wonderful land. That's right. At Dale Campbell. Now, that's right. I'm not broadcasting live from this Volvo self-driving car, but it would be pretty cool to do that. A car will be a part of the Australian first trial. Oh, it was on trial at Adelaide's Southern Expressway. It's a car that will be a part of Australia's first trial of driverless technology that has been revealed in Adelaide. The Volvo XC90 model already features cameras, a radar, automatic braking, and blindside indicators. Volvo Cars Australia Managing Director Kevin McCann said that all those with all those features, it's a matter of tweaking the software to allow it to go driverless. Quote, "It's already an evolution of our safety technology in many years of safety research that has been conducting," said Mr. Cairn. Quote, "One of the findings that we've had many accidents could be avoided if the driver had made a quick decision, but a human's not physically capable of doing that, so we've put devices in the car that can make these decisions more quickly," unquote. Adelaide Southern Expressway will be closed on Saturday for the test, where the car will be driven to in convoy, to show how it behaves in traffic and how it responds to lane markings and street signs. Volvos will be conducting the test in conjunction with Flinders University, Cambridge Milton University, the RAA, Conda Wireless, ARRB, and Bosch. Why is Bosch there? Why is the maker of ovens anyway, technology thing, which has engineers in Australia, developing driverless technology. There you go. The state government has introduced new laws in Parliament to make it easier for manufacturers of cars like these to test their vehicles on Southern Australian roads. The government hopes the legislation changes will attract tech giants like Google to perform these tests in not only Australia, but in South Australia. Mr. Ken says, while the technology was there, it would have taken some time for all cars to go driverless. Quote, "It's not the world suddenly switched completely from cars that were driven by people that cars would be driven by technology," he says. "But there'll be certain parts of the road where technology is applicable and the autonomous features of the car can take over from the driver. But there are many types of situations where the driver is in control," unquote. I suggest in early stages would be major highways, freeways, high traffic situations where the car can officially work in a convoy with each other. While technology is moving forward, it needs legislators to keep it up. As there are currently legal restrictions on how much cars can do, the car is capable for now, Mr. Cairn said. This particular trial on Saturday needs a software adjustment to be able to do it, but it's a matter of when the framework and the legislations allow us when they're ready to bring the cars to the market. It's pretty cool. You know what I mean? Like, it's pretty cool. It's a sleek looking SUV style of car. It's something that you'd take your nuclear family on for a weekend away camping in a kind of cabin-like environment. That is oddly specific. that is very, very oddly specific. But no, it's a pretty cool looking car. It's a standard SUV style car, and it doesn't look. It maybe with all of its dangles, all of its stuff on it as well. I think it's gonna look a little different, of course, because it's gonna have the sort of features that you would want a driverless car to have, like cameras on the outside and that sort of thing as well. You know, you would want certain things from an autonomous driving car, but it without all of that stuff, it looks sharp. It looks pretty cool, I think, and it would be good for the legislators in Adelaide if they were to pass certain things as well in that respect, because they could test more autonomous cars on the same route and have it be more of a test as well in that sort of respect, because you would want kind of you would want a test to kind of come in, like you want a test track kind of thing. They're thinking of doing a street test track, which is cool. Yeah, I like this car. It's great to see technologies like this actually finally taking off as well. It's great to see. It's the ABC. It's finally, yeah, there you go. So, and the legislators need to get their butt in gear and not kind of hob along around this sort of thing as well, because they need to kind of create a situation where this is normal. Like, I don't see. Okay. I don't see any harm in terms of the actual road itself having a driverless car there. It's not going to hurt anyone. Well, it's not going to hurt other street traffic at least. That's one thing as well. You need to kind of make sure that the area is kind of cordoned off as well. And I think it did say that in the article there, that the area will be cordoned off so no other traffic will be able to come through at any point. So, yay, South Australia. Meanwhile, boo, Windows 7. According to IT Pro Portal, I was about to say Portal, Microsoft puts a 1-year deadline on Windows 7 PCs. Ba-da-ba-ba. The adoption of Windows 10 is slowly and that trend is set to continue, largely thanks to Microsoft. In a move that we've seen about 50 million times. Oh, wake up. Sorry. In a usual move, the company has extended the availability of Windows 7 so it can possibly buy more computers and sooner sales. I blah, blah, blah. Wow. Okay. More coffee. Yes. So, those computers. Now, we're talking about computers that have Windows 7 pre-installs. We're not talking about computers with Windows 7. We're talking about pre-installed computers. They'll extend the availability of Windows 7 so we can possibly buy computers with the operating system pre-installed until the end of October next year. So we're not talking about October this year. We're talking about October next. Well, we we couldn't really talk about. Really couldn't talk about October this year because it's November 4th. What's particularly interesting is that it means that Windows 7 will be available to buy for longer than Windows 8. Than Windows 8, excuse me. It would take as an admission of a widespread dislike of Windows 8, and it more offers a lifeline to anyone who wants a new computer without Windows 10 on it. Microsoft has updated its Windows Lifestyle Fact Sheet, which we'll run it through in a sec, to show that PCs with Windows 7 Professional pre-installed will end on October 31st, 2016. Mainstream support for Windows finished in January this year, but extended computer support from until. At 14 January 2020. Once this date passes, we'll find ourselves with another Windows XP situation on our hands. Oh, yes. There will be millions of Windows 7 PCs in use around the world with unpatched vulnerabilities that will never receive further updates. Gotta love having our computers vulnerable to viruses and all the rest of it. I wish that that would go away. So, all right, let's run through this sheet. Okay, let's have a look. End of support refers to the date that Microsoft no longer provides automatic fixes, updates, or online technical assistance. This time to make sure that you have the latest update or service pack installed. Without Microsoft support, you will no longer receive security updates that help, can protect the CV from harmful viruses, spyware, other malicious software that can steal your personal information. So, operating systems, here we go. Windows XP Service Pack 3, end of mainstream support was April 14, 2009. End of extended support. What's... Okay. May I ask a really stupid question? I'm going to ask a really, really stupid question. What does extended... Ah, there you go. Mainstream, minimum of 5 years. General availability, for example, if you buy it... depends on what... Okay, depends on what support you get from them. Okay. So Windows Vista mainstream support ended April 10th, 2012. Extended support is 2017, April 11th, 2017. I still don't understand from its product general availability. Then they will offer extended. Okay, then they will offer extended support. Okay, so this is an end of mainstream report. Okay, there you go. Windows 7 end of mainstream support ended on January 13th this year, but they've offered extended support from January 14th, 2020. Windows 8 is expected to end mainstream support January 9th, 2018 and January 10th, 2023. Windows 10, October 13th, 2020, October 14th, 2025. That is 5 years. Okay. End of sales. General availability, December 31st, 2001. Retail software end of sales, June 30th, 2008. End of sales for PCs with Windows pre-installed, October 22nd, 2010. That is Windows XP. Holy crap. That's a long lifestyle. Windows Vista, January 30th, 2007. End of retail, October 22, 2010. Pre-installed 22nd of October 2011, so that's 1 year, Jesus. Windows 7 Home, Basic Home Premium Ultimate, general availability ends on October 22nd, 2009. Retail software end of sales, October 31st, 2013. End of sales pre-installed October 31st, 2014. 7 Professional, 2009, same, but... End of sales with pre-installed is October 31st, 2016. Windows 8, October 26th, 2012 is general availability. End of retail software, end of sales, October 31, 2014. June 30, 2016 is when they're not coming pre-installed. 8.1, October 18th, 2013, general availability. September 1, 2015 is when they ended the software sales. End of sales with PCs pre-installed, October 31st, 2016. And they are yet to announce pre-sales. Availability for XP Service Pack 1, 2002, retired 2006, SP2, 2004 to 2010, XP SP3, 2008, 2014, Vista 1, 2008, 2011, Vista 2 is still available. That'd be pretty cool to have a computer with Vista still on it. I have a spare computer here. I might have Vista on it. Windows 7, 1, 2011, and 8.1, October 18th, 2013. There you go. You can still get service pack and updates for that. All right, as we continue here on GLS, well, if you are you considering a sea change? Maybe a career change? We have the 700 loophole. No, it's not 700, but aged care is a complicated business. We have the fair warning. You've been warned as we continue here on GLS. I don't know why I'm doing that voice. It's 10:50.
Whatever the time of day, whatever the time of the night, we're here to serve you a big dose of genericness with your host, Dale Campbell.
Thank you for joining us here on a Wednesday here on GLS, whether you're listening to us live or on your hard drive. We appreciate it. However you can tune the show now, want to join aged care in New South Wales? Think again. Australian Ageing Agenda posts today. The primary report that calls for staff to resident ratios and licensing of personal care workers will provide an argument cost the system $500 million if introduced nationally. Oh, yes. The staffing levels and the regulations are a bit vague. So, why do we have to make aged care complicated? Now we're making aged care complicated. You're kidding me, right? We're making aged care one of the most complicated systems in the world. So, an inquiry report released last week also called the New South Wales government to urge the Commonwealth to introduce new requirements for facilities to list their staffing skill sets on My Aged Care website and for additional funding, training funds for registered nurses. There are mixed views over the current regulations. So, okay. There are mixed views over the country. The report noted that there were deep division over effectiveness of the Commonwealth's aged care regulatory framework among the industry's participants, which included providers and their peaks, GP nurses, unions, senior advocates, excuse me, and researchers. Some stakeholders opposed mandated requirement for RNs on the basis of the Commonwealth framework already provided standards, outcomes, monitoring, and sanctions, while those argued that inadequate with the system in regards to accreditation, compliance, and monitoring of facilities and their staffing standards prescribed. While the committee acknowledges the flexibility of the current system in allowing aged care facilities to determine and provide staffing skills and mix to meet varying needs residents, it shares the concerns that inquiry participants who feel that staffing standard requiring, quote, appropriately skilled and qualified staff is too vague and allows a wide latitude in its interpretation, the inquiry concluded. The accreditation standards do not prescribe to the type of staff qualifications required by staff or the number of staff who currently work in the aged care facility, the report noted. The way of residential facilities were described by the inquiry participants as being monitored and assessed against the accreditation standards was troublesome, it concluded. There were Mrs. Hilday was one of the people who put together this report as well. She says there was a lot of unannounced visits which providers were not informed about, and assessors were very thorough about talking to residents and families. Ms. Holliday said the findings the accreditation system relied on paperwork, so it didn't rely on anything kind of hard and kind of substantiated. But again, there's way too many visits going on to aged care. Now, I don't run any aged care facilities, but I know you kind of can't take it on face value when it comes to aged care facilities, because aged care facilities are one of those things where you have to kind of be more serious about it as well, because you kind of can't go hillagey-pillagey about aged care. So just some standards would be nice. Some standards in aged care. Let's give back our standards. If we continue here on GLS, well, you know, sometimes the earth opens up. Just casually. As we continue here on GLS, we'll tell you where the earth is opening up. The world is open for inspection. As we continue, it's 11 o'clock.